Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. So good to see live smiling faces here in the crowd. Thank you for coming. I am very happy to say that Dr. Hugh Ross is with us today. Everybody give a cheer. And Hugh's going to be with us again for 4 weeks in a row. Say a cheer. In June, Dave Sargent is going to be teaching us, coming in from the frozen Wyoming. And let's see. Thank you for everybody who brings treats back there. It makes it a wonderful, wonderful class to have treats. And my phone is ringing. That's embarrassing. Sorry about that. Wow. Okay. Did you hear about the guy that goes into the library and he orders fish and chips? And the librarian says, "This is a library." And he says, "Oh, I'll have fish and chips." That was funny. He just didn't get it. All right. All right, I don't have anything more to say, so let's say a prayer and we'll get to Dr. Hugh Ross. Thank you so much, Lord, always for this opportunity we have in this class. What a unique opportunity to worship you with our mind as well as our heart, to think about the Bible and your word from an intellectual basis, and we just round out our faith with the wonderful material and teaching that Hugh Ross gives us every Sunday. We ask your blessing on Hugh as he teaches us this morning, and your blessing on each of us as we go our way this afternoon. Thank you so much. In Jesus' name, amen. Please welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, I want to thank the team here for allowing me to sit. I got sciatica, so I'm in a lot of pain, can't really stand. And I can't complain. It's the first time in my life I've had it. And all of you who are, you know, 6 feet or taller, you know, hey, it's something that happens. And for all of you who don't have a lot of height, you're blessed. So I notice when I travel around the world, places in the world where everybody is tall, a lot of them got back issues. In fact, I can remember one time here at the church where we needed to move a lot of heavy stuff. And all the guys here at the church were having back issues except for me. So it was me and all the ladies that moved all the heavy stuff. So just bear with me on this. We're doing a series on Genesis 1 through 4. We're getting close to wrapping up Genesis chapter 3. But Genesis 3 is where you see the first mention of death in the Bible. And people look at Genesis chapter 3 and often draw some mistaken ideas about what the text is saying about death. So what I'm going to try to do here, we got started last week, or the last time I was here, talking about, well, what does the Bible say about death? And the problem here is people often stop at Genesis 3, see the reference to death, draw the wrong conclusions, and really don't bother to go through the rest of the Bible. In fact, this past week, I was teaching at Redeemer University. That's a university in Hamilton, Ontario, in Canada, and with the faculty there, and just really stressing how we need to work with our students and impress upon them the need to integrate all 66 books of the Bible. Basically, when you see something in the text, hold off until you go through the entire Bible and see everything it's got to say about that subject. Well, what we did the last time I was here 2 weeks ago was we looked at a few features of what the Bible says on death. And number one, God blessed humans with physical death so they would not be eternally spiritually dead. And then if you read Genesis chapter 2 and 3, what you notice is that God warned Adam and Eve, "In the day that you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will die." Well, they didn't immediately experience physical death, but they did experience spiritual death. So Genesis chapter 3 introduces at least two different kinds of death. And if you go through the rest of the Bible, you see there are multiple kinds of death. But what we see here is a distinction between physical death and spiritual death. And how when we died spiritually, God blessed us with spiritual death so that God eventually could deliver us from the far worse consequence of spiritual death. And last time when we were here, we talked about how the difference between angels and human beings. God created two distinct species of intelligent life, one species that's subject to the laws of physics, and one species that is not. The angels are not bound by our space-time dimensions or the laws of physics, but we are. But because we are, we can experience physical death. We're in this realm where we have entropy, we're bound by entropy, things decay. And so God was able to offer us a different pathway than he was able to offer to the fallen angels. But the fallen angels, the demons, there is no pathway for them to be delivered from spiritual death. But because we can experience physical death, there is a pathway. And how God chose to create a world where his son would die. And what I'm responding to, a lot of people look at death in Genesis chapter 3 and say it's all Adam's fault. God had nothing to do with it, but God is all-powerful. Why would he be bound by an action by one of his created beings? But we know that God had a good purpose for death, because long before he created anything all, God the Father, God the Holy Spirit, and God the Son had determined that when they would create, God the Son would die on the behalf of the humans that God would create. So death was always a part of God's plan, even before he created anything at all. And if there was no death before Adam, the tree of life would serve no purpose, because that's one of the speculations people have, that when Adam sinned, it brought death for the first time to all life here on planet Earth, that there was no death of microbes, plants, or animals until Adam sinned. But if that's the case, why would you have the tree of life in the garden? It would serve no purpose. The tree of life was put there so that Adam and Eve and their descendants could partake of the fruit of the tree of life and be delivered from the consequences of the decay in their bodies that inevitably would lead to death. In other words, the tree of life in the Garden of Eden was kind of like a fountain of youth. You could partake of it, and it would reverse the effects of the decay in your bodies that were inevitably leading to death. So it had a healing purpose. But if there was no death before Adam, the tree of life would have served no purpose at all. Another abuse of looking at what happened in Genesis chapter 3, people go back to Genesis chapter 1 and say, notice, during the six creation days, God would stop and see what he created and said, this is good, this is good, this is good. It's repeated five times. And when he's all done, he says, of all of this creation, it is very good. And then people look at death and say, you know, it's not pleasant, it can't be good, and therefore God's very good creation had to be a realm without any death at all. But notice the text does not say that the creation we're in right now is the perfect creation. It says it's the very good creation. But the distinction between what you see in the Bible and the holy books that undergird the other religions of the world, what we see in Christianity is a two creation model. What you see in the other religions of the world is a one creation model. Now, I will admit these other religions will often speak of heaven and hell, but they describe heaven and hell in ways that we can comprehend from our perspective in this universe. In other words, the heaven and hell that you see in Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, Confucianism, it's a heaven and hell that we can visualize, that we can understand as being part of our creation. But what we see in the Bible is that Christianity gives us a two creation model where the new creation is radically different from this creation. The new creation is the ultimately perfect creation. It's the realm where there will be no death, there will be no decay, there will be no suffering, there will be no pain, there will be no evil, but we're not there yet. As Jesus said, in this world you'll have tribulation, but take heart, I've overcome the world. Or you could put it this way, yes, in this world we'll have tribulation, how then can it be very good? It's the very best possible creation for the creator of the universe to enter into our universe and eradicate evil once and for all. So it's the very best possible creation for the eradication of evil and suffering. But as Jesus said, in this realm, in the world we're in right now, universe we're in right now, there will be tribulation. There will be suffering. There will be decay. There will be persecution. But he says, take heart. I'm taking you, those of you who are willing to follow me, into a new creation where none of that will exist. So that's point number four. Let's look at a few other things that the Bible says about death. This is where the greatest misunderstanding happens. People read Genesis 3 and presume that when Adam sinned, this brought death for the first time into God's creation. In other words, they're interpreting the text as saying, not only did no people die until Adam sinned, no birds died, no mammals died, no animals of any kind died, no plants, no microbes died. But what the text tells us in Romans 5:12 and in 1 Corinthians 15:20 to 22, Adam's sin brought death to all people. It did not bring death to all life. Probably the most explicit text on this is Romans 5:12, which makes the point that when Adam sinned, death through sin came upon all people. And the distinction there is of all the life forms that God has created here on planet Earth, we human beings are the only ones that are capable of sin. We're the only ones that experience sin. Your dogs and cats don't sin. They can behave in ways you don't want them to behave, but they don't sin. They're not aware of sin. We humans alone are sinners. It says death through sin. So when it says death through sin, that automatically isolates humans from all other species of life here on planet Earth. And Romans 5:12 ends by saying, Adam's sin brought death to all people. It'd be different if it said, Adam's sin brought death to all life, or brought death to all animals. It doesn't say that. It says it brought death to all people. Nowhere in the Bible does it make any claim that Adam's sin brought death to anything other than human beings. And the fact that you see two qualifications in Romans 5:12, and if you read all the way down through to Romans 5:19, you'll see that those qualifications are repeated. And what you see in the book of Romans is especially true when you look at Romans 7 and 8. Romans 7 and 8 talks about four distinct kinds of death. So in Romans 5, Paul is distinguishing, this is the kind of death I mean. It's the kind of death you get through sin, the kind of death that impacted all people and not all life. And then if you go to 1 Corinthians 15:20 to 22, you'll see the same qualifications are repeated. And the point here is, whenever you see the Bible repeating something two, three, four, five, or six times, this is something we need to take very seriously. And so the text, nowhere in the Bible does it say that there was no death of plants or animals or microbes before humans sinned. Now, people try to press that point, and I've seen this in a number of debates I've had with young earth creationist leaders. They'll say, well, we're not excluding microbial death, and we're not excluding plant death, and they try to claim the Bible never attributes life to microbes and plants. But if you actually read through the entire Bible, you see that that's not the case. We see the same words being used for the life and death of plants as we do for animals. And what I also find interesting is they make a distinction. Well, we're not saying that there was no death of cockroaches and flies and mosquitoes. Those things were dying, but none of the birds and mammals were dying. And this is where I think you have a problem with sentimentality. We humans have been granted by God the capacity to emotionally bond with birds and mammals. And because of that emotional bond, it's like we can't believe that an all-powerful, all-loving God would bring death upon bunny rabbits unless we can blame it on Adam's sin. But here again, The Bible tells us that flies explicitly experience the same kind of life and death that we human beings experience. The Bible doesn't make a distinction. And I think the distinction that people are making here is based on sentimentality. We form a different bond with a dog than we do with a mosquito. You've probably all noticed that, right? And you don't seem to have any qualms at all about swatting and killing a mosquito, but you know, having to put your dog down, that's an emotionally traumatic experience to go through. Mosquitoes, who cares, right? But the point is, the Bible actually uses the same Greek and Hebrew words for the death and life of flies and mosquitoes as it does for bunny rabbits and dogs and cats. Here again, we need to kind of sit back and realize there's a reason why God gave us a capacity for these animals to emotionally bond with us, is to teach us that God created these creatures to emotionally bond and serve and please a higher being. That tells us, likewise, we have been designed to relate to and serve and please a higher being. It was Job in chapter 10 who made the comment, look to these animals, look to these birds of the sky, the beasts of the field. They'll teach you, they'll instruct you. They'll instruct you about deep, important spiritual truths. I mean, as our sin causes us to run away from God, notice our sin causes these animals to run away from us. And as we bond with these animals, as they become emotionally bonded to us, outperform their wild cousins. Likewise, when we bond to our Creator, we outperform our wild cousins. And those of you who've had adult conversions probably recognizes. You know, I didn't come to Christ until I was a sophomore physics student at the University of British Columbia. I was 19 years of age. But what I noticed almost immediately is how my grades dramatically improved after I gave my life to Christ compared to what happened before I gave my life to Christ. In other words, it's that bond that causes us to perform beyond what we normally would. Okay, that's point number five, is that Adam's sin did not bring death to all life, it brought death to all human beings. And so we inherited the sin through Adam, but the real message of Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15, as one man brought death to all of us, one man brings life to all of us. The man Christ Jesus is the one who can deliver us from both physical death and spiritual death. So yes, we might complain, how is it that we all wind up becoming sinners because of what happened to Adam? But again, look at the mystery. The actions of one man can deliver us, all of us, from sin and evil, if we so choose. Number six, entropy existed before Adam sinned. What you see in Romans 8, it talks about this law of corruption or law of decay. And keep in mind, the Bible was communicated to us to speak to all generations of humanity. Because I've run into people say, well, if Genesis 3 and Romans 5 and Romans 8 is talking about entropy, why didn't God use the word entropy? Well, for a good reason, that would only have any possibility of communication if you were living, say, in the late 1900s, 1800s, 1900s, or the 2000s. Given that the Bible is inspired to communicate all generations, it's going to avoid terms and vocabulary that can only communicate to a few generations of humanity. But when it talks about decay, we realize where it talks about tribulation, it's really referring to the second law of thermodynamics, namely that everything is in the process of decay, and the decay continues. It affects everything. Everything in the universe is subject to this pervasive law of decay. And you say, what's the proof of that? Well, you see the proof of that right in Genesis chapters 2 and 3. Namely, what you see in Genesis 2, you see it in Genesis 1, the sun, moon, and stars are shining. And what you notice is after Adam's sin, the sun, moon, and stars are still shining. And incidentally, they're shining at the same intensity that they were before Adam sinned. And you don't have to take a course in astrophysics to realize The reason why stars shine is because of the second law of thermodynamics. Stars are decaying, and through that decay, they radiate light. And if you were to change the rate of decay ever so slightly, then the sun would shine at an intensity that would bring about the death of all life on planet Earth. You say, well, how subtle the change we're talking about? Well, if we're to change the second law of thermodynamics, the way it operates, by about one part in 10,000 trillion, 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 then life would not be possible here on planet Earth. So even the tiniest change in the law of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, would mean that you couldn't have life after the fall. And so what happened at the fall, the laws of physics didn't change, humanity changed. And so when you look at the curse that you see in Genesis 3, 17, it says, cursed is the ground because of you. It's not cursed because of physics of the ground change. It became cursed because now we've got sinful human beings trying to manage that ground. And we're going to see this in Genesis chapter 4, where Cain gets ejected into the land of Nod, and he's being told by God, the ground is not going to produce for you like it did. When you look at Cain and Abel, Cain was the one that was kind of the farmer growing crops. Abel was the one that was keeping animal herds. And basically, when Cain murdered his brother Abel, God said, from now on, the ground is not going to produce. Well, the ground wasn't producing as it did before Adam and Eve sinned. But basically, it's making the point to Cain, hey, because of the grievous sin you've committed, the ground is going to produce even less. And this is the point. The more we sin, the less productive our agricultural land will be. And so entropy existed before Adam sinned. It existed after Adam sinned. There was no fundamental change in the laws of physics. Gravity is the same. So Adam and Eve were not walking in a different way than they were after the fall compared to before the fall. The law of gravity was exactly what it was. The law of electromagnetism was exactly like it was. And this leads to a major debate that you see in Christendom. Well, God tells us that the creation was very good in Genesis chapter 2, at the beginning of Genesis chapter 2, and they basically claim there were no natural disasters until Adam sinned. So no earthquakes, no wildfires, no disease, no cancer, but all of that happened after Adam sinned. So Adam's the one to blame for all the suffering we go through, all the floods, the droughts, etc. But I've argued in my book More Than a Theory that natural disasters are actually part of God's very good creation. Pick any natural disaster that you want. Say wildfires. I mean, we live here in Southern California. Wildfires are a part of our life. I've been evacuated. Well, I haven't. The interesting thing is, every time our family comes in under an evacuation order, I'm out of town ministering somewhere. So my wife and sons are always saying, how is it that every time we get faced with something like this, you happen to be out of town? So, but it is true. If you live here in Southern California, wildfires are part of the norm. But actually, what happened is that since the Los Angeles Basin has become heavily settled, wildfires actually do more damage than they did before it became heavily settled. And what you see in every part of the world is that you need wildfires breaking out a certain rate in order to optimally benefit the environment. So for example, consider this. What if there were no wildfires at all anywhere in the world? If that were the case, our soils would be charcoal deficient. And it's the implanting of charcoals in the soil that condition the soil, allow the soil to absorb more water and more nutrients. And notice, again, here in Southern California, we don't get rain every month of the year. We have several months where you can basically forget about taking a tent when you go backpacking. You know it's not going to rain. It's just not going to happen. But what is it that allows the soils to retain enough water to sustain plant life throughout the year? The wildfires are a big part of that. Now, what we've now been able to discover here in Southern California, the optimal wildfire rate in order to maximally benefit the vegetation here in Southern California is to have a wildfire happening about once every 8 years. What happens when you got a lot of humans living here, they say, we don't like these wildfires. They burn down our homes and they put ash in the atmosphere. And so you have what's called wildfire suppression. And a lot of us can remember what happened a couple of years ago when a massive wildfire broke out, literally just a few blocks north of where our church is right here. I mean, 20 families in this church lost their homes because of the wildfire that spread through Altadena and Eaton Canyon and actually came right over the mountains. It didn't stop until it hit Santa Anita Boulevard. And so if you're a resident here in Sierra Madre, you can remember the fires coming right down to the upper streets of Sierra Madre. And also there was a big fire that happened in Palos Verdes. And we have a couple that comes to this class. They actually drive all the way from Palos Verdes to attend this class when they can. And they lost. Their home, by the way, was undamaged, but all the homes around them were burnt out. And I've been told they're still not allowed to go back into their home because of all the chemical problems that they had in putting out that fire. You know what made those two fires so deadly is the fact that we suppressed fire in that region for about 20 years. When you suppress it that long, when you do get a fire, it really becomes an intense fire. So intense that you get embers being blown several miles and igniting fires in places that otherwise wouldn't happen. The optimal fire rate here is 8 years, but in other parts of the country it's different. Where I grew up in British Columbia, the average wildfire rate was every year. But what's interesting about British Columbia, it's very mountainous. It does get quite a bit of rain. And what happens is that you wind up getting the tops of the mountains burnt because that's where there's the least amount of water. And what I notice in the mountaineering we've done in British Columbia, there'd be a wildfire running around us. And I'd say, well, are we at risk? They said, no. The fire is going to burn down to a certain level where the soil is wet and it'll stop. They don't even bother putting the fire out because they know that there's a natural extinction and it's actually good for the top of the mountain to be burnt off. It's going to enable fresh vegetation to grow there. It's going to enhance the ecosystem. Different parts of the world have a different optimal wildfire rate. But if there was no wildfires at all, things would be far worse. We wouldn't get the charcoal coming to the soil like we do need. And you wouldn't be able, in fact, here in California, it's famous for the sequoias and redwoods, right? We wouldn't have any sequoias and redwoods if it wasn't for forest fires. Those are trees where their seeds only germinate when there's an intense hot fire. It needs fire in order to reproduce, and it takes the fires to burn out all the hemlocks, for example. If the forest gets choked full of hemlocks, it basically squeezes out the sequoias and the redwoods, and you don't have any at all. There's a reason why you only see redwoods and sequoias in this part of the United States. You don't see them in Canada. Basically, it's through California, parts of southern Oregon, and that's it. It can only happen in regions where they do have these seasonal intense wildfires that actually enable. And it actually helps the wildlife. When you burn off all the hemlocks and firs, you now just have these redwoods and sequoias standing, which means it's now easy for the wildlife to wander through the forest. If you've ever been to Sequoia National Park, you notice you can walk through the forest unimpeded. That's not the case, say, if you were to go to the Amazon jungle, or do you go to coastal state of Washington or British Columbia. The undergrowth there is just so thick with thorny bushes and plants, you literally can't walk through it. Whereas here in Sequoia National Park, it's easy to walk through the forest because all the other stuff has been burnt up. It makes for an easy path through that. That's just one example. Earthquakes happen here, right? You need earthquakes. If you don't have any earthquakes, you don't have any recycling of the nutrients that all life needs. It's that plate tectonic activity that recycles the nutrients that life needs. But you don't want too much of a good thing, right? And what we notice is the intensity and level of earthquakes is optimal for recycling the nutrients without doing too much damage to our homes and to life. However, it was Jesus who said, "Do not build your house on sand, build it on the rock." Give you two examples. Haiti had a magnitude 7.4 earthquake. New Zealand had one at 7.4. Okay, in New Zealand, what was the death toll? Two people died. Almost no structures were damaged. What happened in Haiti? Widespread structural damage, and about 200,000 people lost their lives. What's the difference? You go to Haiti, you had these cardboard shacks, people were building their domiciles in places where the soil was very unstable, whereas in New Zealand, they knew that they were gonna have earthquakes, and they had building codes in place that ensured, hey, when a big earthquake happens, good chance your home's gonna survive and you're not gonna lose your life. So identical earthquake, radically different consequences. And basically Jesus was saying, in this world you'll have tribulation. Well, if you're going to have tribulation, you need to prepare for it, but also recognize that which causes tribulation is all optimally designed to maximize our comfort and blessing here in this planet. It's also true of hurricanes. We don't really get hurricanes here in California, but you certainly get them on the east coast of North America. But it's those earthquakes that basically act as a thermostat. If the ocean gets too hot, it generates a hurricane. Hurricane creates a vast cloud, begins to drop a lot of rain. It cools that part of the ocean. The hurricane moves over the land, and likewise, the hot parts of the land masses get cooled off. And if you go to the eastern states, about half of the rainfall comes from hurricanes. Take the hurricanes away, you wouldn't have that. New research is showing that as hurricanes move from the deep ocean and come towards the land, they dump chlorophyll right by the seashore, and that chlorophyll is a huge benefit to plant and animal life in that region. So bottom line is, we can thank God for hurricanes, but we also can thank God they don't last that long and they're just the right level of intensity. If it was less intense, we wouldn't get the benefit from the hurricanes. It was more intense, they would cause more destruction and death. They're all at the optimal level. But once again, it's in the context. Don't build your house on sand, build it on the rock. And when, you know, having gone to places like Florida, what alarms me is you go to, say, the eastern, what did they have there? They have these little villages for senior citizens. Where they're living in these mobile homes. And it's like, wait a minute, this is hurricane territory. And what are we doing? We're putting these senior citizens who have the most difficult time escaping the catastrophe in the most unsafe domiciles. And part of it is their fault. They like living near the beach, and they like the fact that these mobile homes are cheap. They live there, but they're putting themselves at great risk. It's interesting that the Native Americans, if you go back before the Europeans came, they refused to build any towns or villages on the eastern seaboard of Florida. They said, we're not gonna live there. They moved away from there. They said, we don't care if it's a nice beach with great waves. We're just not gonna live there. The risk is too high. I could go on and talk about other forms of disasters, tornadoes. Tornadoes too optimally benefit human civilization. So we call them acts of God. In one sense, I think that's an appropriate terminology. They are an act of God in that they're optimally designed to maximally benefit plant life, animal life, and especially we human beings. But we also need to realize we need to be wise in how we manage our planet for ourselves and the benefit of all life. That's Genesis chapter 1. God put Adam and Eve and all humanity in charge of the resources of planet Earth to manage it for our benefit and the benefit of all life, which means we need to recognize these kinds of events will happen and we need to appropriately prepare for them. And one I've just written about is that, you know, you really don't want an asteroid crashing into your home. It's going to do a lot of damage. And unfortunately, we got this atmosphere which burns up the comets and asteroids as they come through the atmosphere, with a few exceptions where they're big enough and they crash into the Earth. And God could have designed our planet Earth where we don't get any of these collisions. But if that were the case, our planet would gradually get desiccated. Because we have the gravity that planet Earth has, and by the way, you can't make our planet any more massive. If you do, you lose the plate tectonics that we need to recycle the nutrients. We're literally living on the biggest rocky planet on which life can possibly exist. But because of that, our gravity is not quite strong enough to keep all the water, and so we lose a tiny amount of water through gravitational escape to interstellar space. And incidentally, that's a good thing, because if we had a stronger gravitational pull, now we'd be holding on to things like methane and ammonia with more efficiency. And so you don't want that. You do need to lose a little bit of water, but we happen to be living in a planetary system where we get a gradual delivery of tiny quantities of water from comets. Comets are 85% frozen water, and most of the comets that hit us are so tiny that they burn up in the atmosphere, but they deliver enough water to replace the water that we lose to interplanetary space. So everything is optimal. So yeah, next time you have to celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God that we get just the right bombardment of comets. We also get just the right bombardment of asteroids. I mean, some of these asteroids, if you look at the asteroid belt, about 3/4 of them are what we call rocky asteroids, made up of silicon and oxygen and other minerals. And they do deliver, a lot of valuable nutrients to us. But 1/4 of the asteroids are what we call metal asteroids. They're basically big, huge chunks of iron, nickel, cobalt, gold, silver, uranium, thorium, platinum, etc. And there's one of these big asteroids that struck near Johannesburg, South Africa, kind of punctured into the Earth about 300 billion years ago. But that's now the source of 80% of the gold that we have in circulation on planet Earth, and 80% of the platinum, all come from one asteroid. Now, fortunately, it collided with the Earth long before we showed up. And there's also an asteroid that hit in Canada, a town called Sudbury, on in Ontario there, and that's responsible for half the nickel that's in circulation. So, and also explains how what we're going to see in Genesis chapter 4, it talks about Tubal-Cain, how he was a forger of bronze and other metals. And what we now know is what was happening even during the Ice Age, before humans had launched a global civilization, is that people in the north would basically wait for the winter to come when you got snow on the ground, and then they would send search parties out to look for rocks, knowing that a lot of those rocks were these iron-rich meteorites. And those meteorites that come down, they're a better grade of stainless steel than you get from a steel factory. So we now know that ancient peoples, I mean, I used to, when I was being educated as a child, they're saying the Iron Age didn't hit until no earlier than 3,000 years ago. We now know that's incorrect. The Iron Age goes back at least 16,000 years, because we have people here in North America that were gathering, and also in Northern Europe, they'd be gathering these stainless steel meteorites and cold forging them into sophisticated tools. So people look at Genesis 4 and say this can't possibly be true. We now know that it could indeed be true. Now, I was asked to talk about this when I was speaking at Redeemer University a few days ago, and they said, we know this asteroid did hit near Johannesburg. Can't we just grab one of those asteroids and begin to mine it and lower the price of gold and platinum? And I said, well, you got a point there. Because of how valuable and rare platinum is, we got a problem with a lot of cancer drugs. I mean, a lot of the really effective chemotherapy drugs are platinum-based. But I talked to my son, who's in the medical arena, and he said, some of those drugs, it's $10,000 a dose. And if you got this kind of cancer, you need to be taking that dose on a regular basis. It explains why people who have these kinds of cancers literally become financially broke because of how expensive these chemotherapy drugs are. And so there's some motivation. Hey, we know there's asteroids out there that got a huge amount of platinum in them, a lot of gold. Why don't we go and grab one? In fact, I think it's, NASA right now is sending a spacecraft to Psyche. Psyche is one of these extremely metal-rich asteroids, and it's been valued at $10 quintillion. And that's because it's quite big. It's the biggest of these known metal asteroids. And it's like, we're not going to mine that. It's too far away. However, NASA has said, we found two small ones. And these two small ones actually make close pathways by the Earth. We just have to wait till the next time it comes near the Earth. And for very little money, we can send a spacecraft out there, nudge it into an Earth orbit, have it orbiting the Earth, then we can mine all the platinum and gold and silver and uranium and thorium in it, and we can make a lot of money. Hey, that might even take you the U.S. national debt, right? Because the one that's a little more than a kilometer across, it's valued at $20 trillion. The one that's about 2 kilometers across is valued at over $30 trillion. So yeah, NASA is seriously considering doing this. And and the wonderful thing is, these are metals that aren't ores. It's basically pure platinum, pure gold, pure osmium, all these expensive metals, and we can go and mine that. I was speaking at a church in St. Louis, and they said, we want you to talk about, is it possible that could be a fulfillment of Revelation chapter 8? Because Revelation chapter 8 talks about a star crashing into the earth and poisoning a third of the world's fresh water supply. I said, yeah, that could do it. Put one of these things in an Earth orbit, and you mine it. And the problem with these asteroids is when they're that small, they're not spherically shaped. They've got an oblong shape, which makes it really challenging to determine its orbit and maintain orbital stability. So if you mine the wrong chunk off the asteroid, you could have its orbit decay and crash into the Earth. Which is why when I've been speaking to NASA audiences, I say, let's put it in a lunar orbit. If we put it in a lunar orbit, and we run into a problem of not mining it the correct way, it'll crash into the moon, and it's not going to do any damage. Whereas if we put it in an Earth orbit, and we make a mistake like that, what happens if it crashes into Manhattan? That could really do some significant damage. And they said, well, the problem with that is if we put it in a lunar orbit, it's much more expensive to mine. It's way cheaper to put it in Earth orbit and mine it that way. So maybe, and I just say that's a maybe, that how we could see the fulfillment of Revelation chapter 8. What I did tell the audience in St. Louis is that we need to interpret these disasters that are prophesied to happen to humanity in Revelation 6, 8, and 16 in the context of what happened in the book of Exodus with the 10 plagues. What you notice with those 10 plagues, they were aimed only at the unbelievers. The believers were always protected. And they're aimed at the unbelievers to make them aware there is a God out there. And they also recognize, hey, the Egyptians that repented and became part of the people of God, they were protected. And so what you see in Exodus 15 is that when the children of Israel left the land of Egypt to go to the land of promise, the land of Canaan, a huge number of Egyptians joined them. In fact, if you actually look at the population that left the land of Egypt to go to the land of promise, it's clear that at least 80% of them were not the blood descendants of Jacob. They were people throughout the Egyptian empire who said, we want to become part of the people of God. And notice the pathway was always open for a Gentile to become a Jew. And so I think that gives us a different context. The vast majority of those that left with Moses were not blood descendants of Jacob. They were converted people throughout the whole of the Egyptian empire. And I think that's the way to interpret what's going on in the book of Revelation. God's going to do these things to bring an uncountable number of people to faith in Jesus Christ. And just like with the 10 plagues, each plague was a little more intense than the previous one, because some people need to be shaken up a little more than others to realize, I need to repent and follow Christ. Now, that was a little bit of a diversion, and now I see I've gone over time. So we got four more to go. I think we got four more to go. Let me see. We got five more to go. So we'll hit those next week, and we're going to move on to a new subject, which will be Revelation, Genesis chapter 3 ends with three big promises. So if you want to do a little advanced study, look at the end of Genesis chapter 3 and see what those big promises are. And I'll give you a tip. One looks like something that's not a promise at all. It's like, boy, that doesn't seem very pleasant. But what looks like an unpleasant promise actually is the best thing of all. So that's what we'll look at next week. We'll finish this up, then we'll get into the promises. We're also going to see what Genesis chapter 3 teaches about the Trinity. Then we're going to dive into Genesis chapter 4. And the key thing about Genesis chapter 4, notice that God is asking questions. He's asking questions of Cain where he already knows the answer. How many of you have ever had your mother ask you a question where it's clear she knew the answer? And why did your mother do that? That's kind of a little key what Genesis chapter 4 is all about. But I like to look at Genesis chapter 4 as a handbook for parents. Just like God was dealing with Cain and his relatives, there's a handbook there on how we can better help our children avoid evil and pursue virtue. Okay, with that, let's take questions. And as always, we're going to alternate between people that are here in person and people who are joining us online from different nations around the world. So let's begin with an online question.
All right, our first online question is a bit long, so bear with me. This is from Craig McMahon. I was wondering what your response would be to Dr. Lisa Randall's argument that the inflationary period of the Big Bang probably continued in the non-observable universe throughout the 13.8 billion years since the Big Bang. Her argument seemed to be based on the homogeneity principle and recent results that seems to suggest that the flatness of space is even greater than we have previously thought. Dr. Randall's conclusion was that the size of the observable universe is infinitesimal compared to the non-observable universe.
Yeah, I think she's making good points that if you've got a geometrically flat universe, and yes, it measures to be flat to a little better than three places of the decimal, and she's making the prediction that's going to prove to be even flatter than that. That's where I kind of part company with her, because instrumentally, we've kind of pushed measurements of the geometry of the universe to the theoretical limit. We might get it to four places of the decimal. I don't think we'll ever get it to five places of the decimal. And even four is going to be a challenge. And by the way, when I talk about a flat geometry, it's not flat like a piece of paper. So in three dimensions, a flat geometry is a plane. In four dimensions, a flat geometry is either a saddle or a spherical shape. So it's three-dimensionally flat, not two-dimensionally flat. Don't try to visualize it. It can't be done. But we can develop the mathematics to show that's the way it is, and we got measurements to show us. But it does have the consequence of telling us that there had to be some kind of inflation event in the early universe. And if the universe is very close to flat, that means that the inflation event, and again, if you're not familiar with that term, you have the cosmic beginning where the universe is infinitesimally small, an infinitesimally small volume, and it expands. But to explain why the universe is big as it is, where the galaxies are separated by the distances they are, in only 13.8 billion years, there has to be a period when the universe is extremely young, where it hyperinflates. And so what do you mean by hyperinflation? Where the universe expands millions of times faster than the velocity of light. So we're talking a dramatic increase in the expansion rate of the universe. Now, it doesn't last long. This inflation event happens between about 10 to the minus 32 and 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the creation event. But in that very tiny window of time, the universe expands from the size of about an atom to the size of, say, a grapefruit or an orange. And you say, it doesn't sound like much, but given a little time you got, that really does translate into an expansion that's millions of times faster. But that hyper-expansion basically means that during that expansion period, when the universe is about a 10 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old, you have this thermal bath, this hot thermal chaotic bath that basically erases all memory of what happened before. And so that's the limit to where we can go with our telescopes. We can't get any direct imaging of what's going on before the inflation event, because the inflation event erases 100% of the memory of what happened before. Now, what's happening is that some theoreticians take advantage of that and saying, well, if all information before that event is erased, maybe we can widely speculate about what happened before that event. And so there's a number of papers out there where they say, well, the space-time theorems prove that there's a beginning, but they only prove that there's a beginning to the expansion of the universe, that there's a beginning to the inflation event. Maybe there's something exotic that goes on before that event, and because we can't tell, we can freely speculate. And so they've come up with a number of speculations that maybe we can escape the beginning. But the escape of the beginning is always based on introducing something that we can't see or detect. So they'll speculate, well, maybe there's another dimension of time. Maybe there's extra dimensions of space. And if that's the case, we can actually find ways to get around the space-time theorems. Or they speculate, maybe the velocity of light in that era is no longer a constant. Maybe it's millions of times faster. And likewise, they can do that with other laws and constants of physics. However, and I've debated some cosmologists who are going down that pathway and said, well, you know, these speculations that you're throwing out there reminds me of the things we talked about at a conference we had at Cambridge University in England, where we had 8 Christian philosophers and 8 Christian physical scientists speculate about God, eternity, and time. And those are the things we talked about and said, well, join the club. You're now on Christian turf, where we actually think about what was God doing before the beginning of the time dimension of a universe, or before the beginning of expansion, or before the beginning of the inflation event. Key Bible verse, Hebrews 11:3. The universe we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. And so all these speculations in that context, there is a boundary to what we can detect. And we're talking about what we conceivably detect, not necessarily have detected, what we can conceivably detect. There's a beginning to all that. So whenever people say, hey, I don't think there's a beginning to the universe, what's your definition of the universe? What's your definition of the beginning? And by the way, we have in Mark 10, where Jesus talks about the beginning. And people look at that passage and say, oh, Jesus is talking about the beginning of the universe. Well, if we look at the context, the whole chapter is about marriage and divorce. He's talking about the beginning of marriage. He's not talking about the beginning of the universe. That's important. Wherever you see a scientist or a Bible scholar talking about a beginning, what kind of beginning are you talking about? Now, I've actually written a position paper on this. I finished it literally yesterday. So it's going to be going up on our new website. It's going to be released probably in another few weeks, and basically making the point in that paper, we've actually found some ways to penetrate what's called the Planck energy. The Planck energy is the energy density that happens right when inflation begins. And we can't probe before inflation, but we actually do see some objects in the universe, gamma ray sources, where the energy density is as much as 8 times greater than what we would see at the beginning of the inflation event. And those energy densities tell us that the speculations that go against the space-time theorems all fail. Basically making the point, the more we learn about the universe, the stronger and stronger case we get that the Bible got it right when he said there's a beginning to everything we can possibly detect. And so But what's happening is the atheists are simply retreating. Okay, we thought we had a room to speculate all the way back to the Planck energy density. Looks like now we got to retreat by a factor of 8. And what I've been pointing out in this position paper, note that the non-theists have been in steady retreat. The realm of speculation space has been getting smaller and smaller and smaller. If you're always retreating, that's a sign you got the wrong model. But as I've engaged some of these people, they say, I'm going to stick to my non-theistic views of world until all the speculative space is gone. Well, that's equivalent to me saying, I'm not going to believe that my wife exists until I develop absolute proof that she does exist. The truth is, all I've got is a high probability. But the probability gets higher and higher with every year that we are married. And hey, I actually committed marriage vows to her based on less than absolute proof on the day that we got married. But I did agree that the evidence that she existed at that time was more than strong enough for me to commit to be a life partner with her. And every year we're married, that evidence goes stronger. Point is, we humans are constrained by the physics of the universe, which means we can never come up with absolute proof of anything. And so watch out for the atheists who say, I will not believe until I got absolute proof that God exists. Well, you get up in the morning without absolute proof that the sun's going to keep shining. You need to be consistent with how you behave. If the probability that God exists is higher than the probability that you've been married to a woman for 40 years, that should be good enough to commit your life to Jesus Christ. Okay, the position paper will be coming out soon. And by the way, it's only 3 pages. Got it all condensed, no citations of literature, because we already have that in a lot of our books. But it's a way of quickly giving people an idea why we can be confident that the Bible got it right when it said, God, in the beginning, created the heavens and the earth. Okay, Doug.
I see.
Yeah, there's bright lights up here, sorry.
I'm kind of going to drift away from this astrophysics thing, although I know it really has a lot of value. God already knows the answers to all these things, but, you know, there's value for it. The way I see it, like, you know, for evangelism and medical advances, all these things to understand the universe. I commend you for all the hard work that you put in over your life to learn all these things and use them for the glory of God. Hallelujah for that, you know. I don't think you get enough recognition for that, but I know you're not doing it for the recognition. You're doing it for the kingdom's work, so thank God for you. And just a little side comment, I watched a debate between Fazel Rana and Aaron Raw, and I think Fazel Rana was a perfect gentleman throughout the debate. I've seen debates with this Aaron Raw, an atheist, many times, where this guy Stewart just totally lost his temper with Aaron Raw because he could agitate you. But man, it was a great discussion. I can tell that day, and probably in general, Fazel Rana really is a good listener and has prepared himself to really be an evangelist like you have, in a way. About the animal thing, animal planet, the soulish animals, a lot of people who have dogs, they say the dogs have like a expression of guilt, you know, and I think you've talked about this before, like they kind of mimic the expressions of us. But it almost seems like they do know right and wrong somehow. So I was wondering if you could comment on that. And I'm not necessarily going to ask you to repeat the story about the Backstreet Boys cockatoo. But about the guilty expressions of dogs. And I've heard like crows can learn to hide your keys and go in your wallet and hide your driver's license. And it seems like they have a sense of humor. And then you have chimps laughing. I mean, this whole mimicking thing really has me fascinated. Can you comment on it? Thank you.
Sure. You will see an article I've written on the reasons.org website about the guilty dog syndrome. because that's been cited as evidence. You know, we're not the only sinners. Look at these dogs. They are obviously experiencing guilt for what they've done. So they're just sinners like us. But there's numerous scientific research papers showing that the dog is simply responding to what the human owner wants to see. So keep in mind, God designed these creatures to serve and please us. And of what brings us pleasure is recognizing that the dog acknowledges they did something that we don't approve of. I mean, I had a pet dog as a child that was really good at the guilty dog syndrome, mainly because the dog was trying to get on the good side of my dad and get the treats that he wanted. And he realized, I'm not going to get those treats unless I put on this particular look. So it worked well for him. So, dogs aren't the only creatures. The thing about dogs is, because they've been bonded to us for so many centuries, they've actually adopted facial expressions. So you look at dogs that have had no contact with humans or the wild dogs, they don't have that. What's happened is we've bred these dogs to emotionally connect with us, and so the dogs have basically learned how to make eye contact with us. I mean, dogs don't normally smile, but we've actually bred dogs so that they smile when we want them to smile. Whereas in the wild, a smile is usually a threat. But they figured, hey, this is how I can get on the good side of my human owner. I'll just smile when they want me to smile. I'll put on a guilty look when they want me to put on a guilty look. And experiments have been done to show that the guilty look has got nothing to do with what they've done. And so a dog may not have misbehaved at all, but if that's what the human wants to see, they'll put that on. And also they notice, if you bring on a human that they're not bonded to, you don't get the response. It happens with a human where they have that intense emotional bond. And again, it's got nothing to do, because they would have dogs that would kind of do something that was against what the human owner wanted. And it didn't make any difference whether the dog did it or not. The dog just knew, if I put on this look, I'm going to get in favor with my human owner and get what I want. So the guilty dog syndrome has got nothing to do with the sin of animals. And we actually cite papers written by people who don't have a Christian worldview perspective, and they've drawn this conclusion. So, but it's easy for us to anthropomorphize. And so we tend to impugn human characteristics and qualities. And the same thing happens where people said, hey, I got a horse that can do mathematics, where the horse will kind of stomp out the number that you want. And what they discovered is, the horse was so bonded to the human owner, it knew just by looking at the human owner when it got the right answer. It knew when to stop stomping. So what's 3 + 5? And the horse would do 8 stomps with its hoof, or not, kind of do this with its head. But it's all, if you take away the human owner, it gets the wrong answer. It only gets the right answer when the human owner of the cow or the horse is there. So yeah, the horse is not doing arithmetic. It's simply all based on the emotional relationship the horse has. And you mentioned crows and ravens. They're really good at finding out what works to get that connection.
Just a little short follow-up about the, I asked about laugh, if they have a sense of humor. You see chimpanzees laughing, playing around. Do they have a sense of humor? Sorry, but that's the most part of my question.
Do animals have a sense of humor? They know that we human beings have a sense of humor. And they like to play up to us. I mean, these animals are strongly motivated to bond to us and serve and please us. And so, yeah, I had a pet bird once that didn't laugh at all until that bond took place and realized we enjoyed the bird laughing, so it would start laughing. So, again, it's all based on the bond. In the wild, they don't laugh. And so, for one thing, they've noticed with parrots, and with cockatoos, they will not dance to courtship songs in the wild. But when they're bonded to a human being, they'll dance to our favorite music. And I saw that even with the parrot I had, it would do that. If that was interesting, my pet parrot would screech and yell and throw a tantrum when my sisters would play the rock music. But when I played my favorite Bach music, it would do this really cute dance on my shoulder. And so it's all dependent on who the bird is bonded to and what the human owner enjoys. There's a famous case of a cockatoo that doesn't like classical music at all, but really likes the music of the Backstreet Boys. Why? Because its human owner didn't like classical music, but really liked the Backstreet Boys. And that bird knew exactly the favorite Backstreet Boy tune that it would do. You can go on YouTube and just put in cockatoo, Backstreet Boys, you can pop up and watch the video. It's an amazing video, but it's something a bird in the wild would never do.
All right, we got another question online from Tinny W. Hi, Dr. Ross. Is it possible there are two falls? Maybe the cast down fallen angels initiated death among the soulish animals?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, there are. I mean, the fall of Adam is not the only fall. Matter of fact, Adam is not the first sinner. Now, the Bible is very clear. The first one to sin, the first one to fall into sin, was Satan, the most powerful creature that God made, the most intelligent creature that God made, was the first one to sin. The Bible doesn't tell us when he sinned, but does make it clear he certainly sinned before Adam. Adam, after all, Satan was the one that came into the Garden of Eden and was able to deceive Adam and Eve into rebelling against their creator. And as we've already mentioned, God did that on purpose. God could have kept Satan out of the Garden of Eden for all of eternity, away from earth of all of eternity, but God knew by exposing us to the greatest challenge in the context of evil, he could work things out where evil, the possibility of us committing evil, would be completely eradicated. So even Satan is part of God's good creation, in spite of the fact that he committed the sin that he did. Now, it also tells in the Bible that when Satan rebelled, he drew a third of the angels into rebellion against him. Again, exactly when that happened, how much time progressed between Satan's rebellion and the rebellion of the fallen angels, we don't know, but we do know that they fell into sin before any human being fell into sin. So that's about the limit of what we can figure out there.
Hi, Dr. Ross. The question goes kind of back to the earlier part you were sharing on Genesis. I have to give it the example first to ask the question. When I was a little toddler, I was crawling over to touch the television, and my mother said, "Don't touch the television, Ted." So I went and I got a stick, and then I touched the television with the stick. So I know that I inherited a sin nature. And so I know it goes all the way back to our first progenitors, Adam and Eve, and when they ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they sinned and fell. And I don't know how what they're eating, the fruit, say, got into the genes, or how was it that we actually inherited the sin nature from our original parents?
Yeah, great question. And Paul addresses it as a mystery, but he does make it clear, because of the one offense of Adam, all of us are sinners. And that's true even of young children. You know, some people argue, well, we don't become sinners until we hit an age of accountability. But if you're a parent, you realize, you know, my children, they begin to express sin at a very early age. I mean, your comment about touching the TV with a little stick. But people say, well, before the age of two, that doesn't happen. Nothing happens until you hit the terrible twos. And my comment is, the terrible twos start even in the womb. We're all sinners. And what we're not failing to take into account, when a child is, say, 6 months old, their level of development physically and intellectually is such that it's very difficult for us to see the sin that's being expressed. They simply don't have the capability of expressing sin until they're 2 or 3 years of age. Then we can see it easily. But I would argue, based on the book of John, chapter 1, we're all sinners. All of us are sinners, and that would include very young babies, even those in the womb. It's just that it takes a little bit of maturation before it's easy for us to see, but God can see it. So, and you're asking another question? How did we inherit it? Well, we got it from Adam. And yeah, I don't think it's some kind of physical, in other words, there isn't a sin gene inside of you. We've looked at the genome, and you can't really pick out a gene that says, aha, that's what we got from Adam, and all of us have it. Evidently, it's spiritual genetics, not physical genetics. And I think Paul, when you get into Romans 5 through 8, basically makes the point, hey, all of us became sinners through one man, and it's a spiritual genetics. Likewise, there's a spiritual genetics we inherit through the one man, Jesus. So Jesus, just notice that Paul makes that contrast. You got the man Adam, you got the man Jesus. The man Adam made all of us sinners. The man Jesus potentially could make all of us delivered from sin. If we choose to have him do what he can't do for himself, he will do it. It's not a physical act, it's a spiritual act. So it's happening somehow in the spiritual realm. And notice Paul just stops there. He doesn't try to tell you how it happens in the spiritual realm. I don't think any of us know. But I would argue it's not a physical genetics, it's a spiritual genetics. And you say, that is unfair. Why did God make us all sinners through spiritual genetics? I had nothing to do with that. It's like, yeah, but you had nothing to do with the second person of the Trinity offering you deliverance from what you inherited from Adam. And that's Paul's whole point. Yeah, you might think, you know, look what we suffered on account of Adam. Look at what we gained through what Jesus Christ did. It removes all the damage we get from Adam.
Okay, another online question from Omnipo B. Hello, Dr. Ross. Question, what are your thoughts on the Greek Orthodox Church? Do you know of any doctrine they teach that has been declared heretical?
Yeah, I don't. Where people think they find something heretical is that what you see in the Orthodox creedal statements is that they don't express original sin like you see in the Protestant denominations. But I've read their material on original sin. They don't use those words, but they do say, hey, we don't like the way the Protestants describe how we all become sinners. That's what we inherited from Adam. But they also say, we believe that all of us are sinners and that it started with Adam. So I think the claim that the Greek Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Church holds on to heretical teaching, it's more semantic than anything else. And I've commented on this in the book Rescuing Inerrancy. So if you look at that, you'll see a few paragraphs that addresses this origin of sin debate. So, and I've discussed this with Eastern Orthodox theologians, and they say, yeah, we don't like the way the Protestants describe it, but we do all acknowledge that we are sinners, and that happens from Adam. They're just saying, we don't like the fact that it seems like in Protestant theology, they're actually claiming there's some kind of physical genetic link between us and Adam that's responsible for us being sinners. And says, well, Protestant theologians would agree with you. It's not a physical genetic link. But nevertheless, the doctrine of original sin stands. And I think as long as we're careful about how we make those distinctions, hey, we're on the same page.
Hi, Dr. Ross. Thanks for taking our questions. I really appreciate you taking questions about any topic. And my question is, if you know, what causes sciatica? And, and why is it such a weird thing that somebody will get it and have it, and then suddenly the next day it's gone?
Yeah. Well, I've been suffering now from sciatica for almost 4 weeks. And I do have an appointment with a doctor to actually examine it. And you say, well, how come you have to wait so long for an appointment? What he told me was people use back pain as an excuse to get a doctor to prescribe them opiates. And there's an opiate crisis. So they're flooded with people trying to get opiates because they got, quote, back pain. So, and I told them, look, I don't want opiates. I just want this thing to be gone. And he said, that's what a lot of people tell me. And I said, well, opiate will take care of it, but you got to keep taking it. This is the first time I've ever had sciatica in my life. And you say, how do you get it? You usually get it by some strain where you're either pulling on something that's got a lot of weight behind it, or you're lifting weights, or you're carrying something very heavy, where you get distracted by somebody talking to you, or you turn and you twist your back. That's usually the most common cause of it. So I see it happening in airports where people are taking heavy luggage up these escalators. They get to the top and they have to make that sudden turn. And I've often seen people just literally collapse in extreme pain. So, just like that, yeah. So, but the thing I've noticed is that people who are 5 foot tall or shorter, there's almost no incidence of sciatica. So it's the length of your body that tends to stress that. And men get it more often than women, usually because they're taller and they're carrying heavier stuff. So that's why, so it's got nothing to do with the sex, it all has something to do with the way they're behaving. So fortunately, we got technology where we can deal with it, but it can be extremely painful and disabling. So why it can disappear? Okay. What doctors would tell me is that often sciatica is a result of, you know, a vertebrae getting compressed and the soft fluid there leaks out. And once it hardens, then it takes the pressure off the nerve and suddenly it's gone. And that can happen in a single day. It can also take a whole year for it to be relieved. And there are cases where the soft stuff leaves out and it doesn't really repair itself. Most sciatica will repair itself. That's kind of what I'm hoping for. But there are cases where, hey, the vertebrae becomes so compressed that you need to have surgery where they put a spacer in or they make some structure or they put a rod in. But I've been told that surgery is effective in only 60% of the cases. So it's not an ideal option. But hey, things are way better than they were 10 years ago in that case. We got MRI now, which can tell you exactly what's wrong. So if this thing persists, I'm scheduled for an MRI, and then we'll see where we go from there. And by the way, you don't have to take an opiate. They can give you an epidural, kind of what they give to women when they're giving birth to a child where there's extreme pain, that epidural, but it's temporary. It gives you relief for a couple of months, then you got to take it again, and there's a limit to it. It's not a permanent solution. So.
Okay, looks like we have time for one more question. Here's an encouraging comment and question from Salty Apologist, who is a faithful
Salty
watcher
Apologist,
online.
Salty Apologist, that's a good name.
So, well, first, Salty Apologist says, people often ask how I came up with the name Salty Apologist. I got it from Colossians 4:6. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer each person. Inspired, of course, by Dr. Hugh Ross in 1 Peter 3:15, he says, great news, Salty Apologist says. I broke the ice with science in my Sunday school class this morning, and we ended up having a lively discussion, but very respectful. Bottom line, they didn't excommunicate me. I give a thumbs up. Now for the question. How up-to-date is the science in your book, Navigating Genesis? I'm on chapter 17 and was just wondering since it came out in 2015.
Yeah, I wanted to update Navigating Genesis, but I was away on a trip. And when I came back, they said, we already sent it back to the printer for a new reprint. And they said, you're going to have to wait 3 years before you get a chance to update it again. But I told them, look, I don't want that happening again. When you get close to running out of copies, there's a lot of material I want to update in that. In particular, I want to update the chapters I have on Creation Day 3 and 4, because there's new scientific discoveries that make the case that this is really in detail exactly how God did it, much more. It's a much stronger argument than we had when I brought up the book in 2013, I think it was. And also the part about the flood, I got a whole book on the flood. I'm not planning to change a lot about that, but I really want to give people in that book, hey, if you want to go into this in more depth, here's an entire book. And I would change the dates in that book based on what I was able to demonstrate in Noah's Flood Revisited. So yes, I'm hoping that book sells well so I can get the update in sooner rather than later.
Okay, that was pretty quick. Let's squeeze in this one last question. I feel bad if they don't get it. From Sebastian D2G Online, what is the meaning of the tree of life in Revelation, please?
What is the meaning of the tree of life? It says the tree of life will bear fruit for the nations. And you know, we're going into the new creation in Revelation 21 and 22, and it tells us that the followers of Jesus Christ will be managers over that new creation. And when it talks about the nations, I think it's referring to the fact that this is when God creates again. For 6 days, God created. He rested on the seventh day. We're in the seventh day right now. An eighth day is coming when he will create again. And we're going to be managers over what God creates. And so the tree of life is not for us. It's going to be for the nations. And I just see that word nations as referring to God's going to be creating some new distinct kinds of life, and they're going to need access to the tree of life. We won't, but we're going to be teaching them, manage them. We're going to be instructing and teaching the angels. We are the partakers of God's grace, so we're being prepared for careers that the angels will not be able to fulfill.
Thank you, Dr. Ross, and that's our time. Will you please close us in prayer?
Be happy to do that. Father in heaven, we thank you that these early chapters of the Bible, these early chapters of Genesis, so richly prepare us for everything else you got to teach in the book of Scripture. So, Father, I pray that we be blessed as we continue to study this. And, Father, there's so many people we engage that have serious questions about these chapters that cause them to doubt that the Bible is the inspired word from you. Help us to be better equipped to address those questions, to answer them, and guide people into relationship with you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.